Hello and welcome to this week's Liverpool Life podcast. I'm Luke Holliday and I'll be discussing the main news stories in Liverpool, plus a roundup of the latest sport headlines with John Coop. Coming up in this week's show, we'll be looking at the council budget meeting that took place on Wednesday evening and talking to councillors for their reactions.
But the proposals we put forward actually were things they hadn't considered, and so we thought that there were further steps that could be taken.
Plus, find out why Merseyside prisons are becoming overcrowded.
It makes it much more difficult to provide sort of rehabilitation answers that people look to prisons for when a prison is overcrowded.
Plans to raise council tax by 1.9% were approved this week by councillors at the budget meeting. In the Mayor's opening speech, he praised the officers in the council for their hard work in dealing with the cuts coming from central government. I spoke to Councillor Nick Small, who's the Cabinet Member for Employment, Enterprise and Skills, after the meeting.
Well, I think it's a very sensible budget, and I think you know the Mayor's done this in quite a progressive way, in a sensible way. The 1.9 increase council tax protects frontline services, and I think it's a reasonable amount for people to pay. The Greens tonight showed why they are completely unfit to run this city. They're economically illiterate, but there's also a real regressive social element in what they want to do. They want to make the poorest people pay. People in this city can't afford to pay an extra £80, £90, £100 a year, which is what they'd have to do under the Green proposals, and it wouldn't actually protect services in the same way as what the administration's doing. But I do believe that the Mayor's right when he says the city's best days lie ahead of it. I think the people of Liverpool will come out of this. The city will come out of the other end, but the next few years are going to be a difficult few years, make no doubt about that.
2015 marks the midpoint of the three-year budget set out by the Mayor. We know from the past that these budgets have been met with angry protests and people campaigning against the cuts to services in the city. Despite a heavy police presence, not a single protester was in sight, and instead security was needed inside the chamber as Councillor Jake Morrison refused to sit down to a chorus of boos and jeering. Tensions ran high as the Green Party attempted to pass an amendment to raise the council tax by 6% and therefore triggering a referendum. The plans were dismissed as nonsense by the Mayor, and the votes were a resounding 77 against, with only 4 voting yes. I spoke to Green Councillor Sarah Jennings about her thoughts on the meeting.
The Labour administration have said they're doing everything they can to protect the most vulnerable in the city, but the proposals we put forward actually were things they hadn't considered, and so we thought that there were further steps that could be taken. They chose to ignore them, so therefore we voted against the budget. The problem is there's quite often not actual debate around the issues. There's just, as you will have witnessed tonight, a sort of mudslinging match, and usually coming from one side of the chamber to the other. And perpetuating untruths as well isn't helpful for anybody, But we put the amendment there to show that we are in opposition and there are things that can be done differently, probably cognizant of the fact that they're not going to accept those amendments, but nonetheless, we think they're worth saying.
Recent announcement by the Mayor about keeping open services in the city meant the Labour administration were upbeat about the future, but calls were repeated that another 5 years of a Conservative government could bring Liverpool to its knees. A new report has revealed that more than 1,000 prisoners are being doubled up in overcrowded cells in Merseyside. Our reporter Jake Cottrell has been following the story and joins me now in the studio. So Jake, tell me more about the new figures.
The figures show that Merseyside's prisons are above capacity by almost 400 inmates, and more than 1,000 prisoners are being held in cells designed for fewer people than currently occupy them. The statistics have come from the Ministry of Justice and have been obtained by the prison charity, the Howard League for Penal Reform. Rob Priest, a spokesman for the charity, explains to me why they have published the figures.
We've seen in recent months an increase in the number of suicides, number of self-harm incidents, number of incidents of violence in prisons, and we wanted to look into some of the reasons why that might be happening. And what the Howard League has done is it's looked at prison population figures across the country at the end of January this year, 2015, and compared it with how it was 2 years before.
What's the extent of the overcrowding in Merseyside prisons?
The report states that all three Merseyside prisons, Altcourse, Kennet and Walton, are holding more prisoners than they are designed for. Altcourse had the sixth highest level in the country of two prisoners being held in cells designed for one, with almost 600 prisoners held in these conditions.
So why is overcrowding a problem?
There are obviously safety implications when a prison is overcrowded, but Mr. Priest from the Howard League told me that it's more difficult to rehabilitate prisoners when prisons are as full as they currently are.
It makes it much more difficult to provide the sort of rehabilitation answers that people look to prisons for. When a prison is overcrowded, it's more difficult to provide enough places on courses for those prisoners to attend, to pick up the skills and the education required to tackle the root causes of their offending. It can mean that large numbers of prisoners are lying idle on their bunks all day when they could be doing meaningful work, which would help prepare them for life on the outside. And it just leads to a much more toxic atmosphere inside the jails. So there are all sorts of reasons why prison overcrowding is a problem, and we should be doing all we can to reduce it.
Is overcrowding of Merseyside jails a problem that's getting worse?
Well, Walton Prison, which was only at 89% capacity in January 2013, is now holding 33 prisoners more than the safe and decent level determined by the prison service. Alt Course is also becoming more overcrowded. It's designed to hold 794 prisoners, but last month was holding 1,127. This means it is overcrowded by more than 40%. That's equivalent to 333 prisoners. However, Kennet Prison, which was at 166% capacity 2 years ago, is now less overcrowded, but it's still holding 20 more prisoners than it's designed for.
So what can be done about the problem?
The question of how to tackle overcrowding in prisons is a difficult one, but Mr. Pierce suggested that community punishment should be used for less serious crimes rather than putting everyone in jail.
Well, what needs to happen is, firstly, we need a recognition that there's a problem here. For too long, successive governments have been seeking to make the problem go away by cramming more people into prisons and hoping that people won't notice. What's actually happening is that's making problems much worse. We need a recognition that this is a crisis, and then appropriate measures taken. The most appropriate measure to take would be to reduce the prison population. You know, a large number of prisoners in this country have not committed serious violent crime or sexual crime. A lot of the offending is acquisitive in nature and probably could be better dealt with by way of community punishment. And so what really needs to happen is for the ministers to sort of grasp the nettle and recognise that there are too many people in prison to begin with. We need to see a sensible reduction of the prison population so that those people who do need to be in prison can be properly accommodated and there should be proper resources directed to tackling the root causes of their offending.
The Ministry of Justice responded to the report by saying that overcrowding levels are at their lowest for several years. The statistics do show that although overcrowding is clearly a big problem, it is actually at its lowest level since 2007-2008, and the male prison capacity has actually increased.
Thanks for that, Jay. A survey has found that over half of British employers think that young people lack the essential skills needed for the workplace. Beth and Tolly has been following this story.
More than half of UK employers believe a lack of essential skills restrict young people's readiness for work, as found in a report by the British Chambers of Commerce. The survey was released on the first day of National Careers Week, which is focusing on life skills this year. It found that 57% of employers cite a lack of skills like communication, resilience and team working as the main reasons why young people are unprepared for the world of work. The survey also found that a lack of focus on employability and careers advice impacts on young people's prospects. National Careers Week is taking place nationwide until the 6th of March, with workshops, careers fairs and employer visits for young people. The British Chambers of Commerce are proposing a number of measures to get educators and businesses working together to help young people develop the life skills they need to succeed. I spoke to Natasha Downs, Communications Officer at the British Chambers of Commerce, who told me that the interaction between education and businesses is vital.
Here at the British Chambers of Commerce, we think that we need to radically increase the amount of interaction between education and businesses. And we think this will really expose young people to work and inspire yourselves about future careers. And we really think this is a joint responsibility between education, business and government. We have lots of schools and universities that are members of their local chamber, And this is a really great way for them to get access to local businesses so that young people have exposure to the working world before they leave education. So at the British Chambers of Commerce, we've been proposing several measures which we think will help to bridge the gap between education and work. So one of those measures is to measure secondary schools on the career destination of their pupils. So, you know, what jobs they end up in and what kind of salary they have. In terms of uni students, we think that we should promote more enterprise modules to higher and further education providers. So, you know, a student on any course, you know, whether it's medicine or English literature, should have an option to take an enterprise module so that they have that focus on life after uni.
Why do you think young people lack skills like communication and team working nowadays?
Well, the British Chambers of Commerce, we think that part of the reason is that schools and universities are obviously focused on academic achievement and results. And of course, that is really important. But we also need to look at ways to shift some of that focus onto soft skills, like team working, presentation skills and resilience. Why employers think young people are unprepared is that, you know, they haven't had previous work experience and that they don't have those soft skills that really help them succeed in their career.
So what can National Careers Week do for young people across the country then?
Well, for us, we feel like National Careers Week is just a really excellent time to reflect on why young people go to school or university in the first place. Of course, gaining knowledge, you know, strong qualifications is important, but also gaining soft skills to live a fulfilling life after school or uni, you know, really helps prepare them for the world of work. You know, that's what matters to employers, and businesses often hire on attitude. If young people can focus on getting excellent work experience, and exposure to work, if they can benefit from having brilliant careers advice, if they can have the option to take enterprise modules, and if they have the support of local education and also local businesses to help them get there, then we think that will be really effective, not just for those individuals, but also businesses and the wider economy.
That was Natasha Downs from the British Chambers of Commerce talking to our reporter Beth and Tolly. Coming up in the next part of the programme, find out what the people of Liverpool think of plans to ban junk food TV adverts from being aired before the watershed.
I don't know if it's about the pre-watershed thing, but I think it starts with individual parents, to be honest.
For more on all the latest news, sport, entertainment, views and reviews, bookmark jmu-journalism.org.uk.
A new report carried out by a group of charities and the University of Chester has revealed the number of people in the North West using food banks has risen. The study claims this is a direct result of faults in the welfare system. Our reporter Sinéan Monro has been following the story.
The Cheshire Hunger Report has revealed that one of the most common reasons for benefit sanctions is because of missed appointments, and difficulties have come up where people change from claiming job seekers allowance to employment and support allowance. Anne Danks, manager of the Trussell Trust Fund, Northern England, spoke to Liverpool Life and said the government need to take the figures seriously.
The majority of clients that have come our way have always been because of welfare benefit delays or changes, and more recently, since sanctions have been brought in, also because of sanctions. So the welfare benefit system has always been a problematic issue for our food bank clients. What we have noticed is with the introduction of sanctions that there has been a clear spike in the number of clients referred to us, and anecdotal evidence and certainly the research that's been done here by West Cheshire Food Bank seems to indicate that the sanctions have been imposed on people at times apparently unfairly or arbitrarily or without those clients fully understanding the implication. The majority of people in poverty are working already, so it's not that they're too lazy to get a job, it's the fact that they're paid very low salaries, they may be paid minimum wage or zero or contract or just low wage.
Charities are now urging the government to take into consideration the seriousness of this issue and the poverty levels across the country.
That was our reporter, Sinéan Monro, talking to Anne Danks, manager of the Trussell Trust Fund. A number of health charities have backed a study into the banning of junk food adverts on TV aired before the watershed. A study found that a majority of parents would prefer it if unhealthy food adverts were only aired after 9 p.m. Our reporter, Ben Matthews, has been looking into the story.
It's an issue that has sparked debate amongst both charities and people in the city of Liverpool. Children's health is a problem that seems to be growing, as a report by the Royal College of Paediatricians and Child Health says almost a third of children in the UK are obese. Claire Rick of the Children's Food Trust says that the advertisers know that children are a very marketable section of society.
We all know that we're all consumers, you know, whatever age we are, to a degree, we are consumers, and children have a lot of consumer power through their parents. And I think any parent will tell you how powerful that sort of pester pound can be. But certainly as a charity, we think we've got a massive responsibility to protect children from confusing and conflicting messages about food, and they are bombarded with messages about food from a very young age, of course. And that's about helping them to become savvy consumers who question the claims that products make and how to read food labels and things like that.
That was Claire Rick of the Children's Food Trust. Now, the people in Liverpool have also had their say on the issue, and I spoke to a number of them today.
I just think there's a lot of pressure on them, and it can lead to bad behaviours, whereas they want junk food all the time.
There's a growing obesity problem in youngsters, and the adverts specifically targeting them could make the problem worse as opposed to better.
They probably do influence kids, and they probably badger their parents into buying them more junk food than they otherwise would, so it's probably a good idea.
We're starting to study right now, the middle of Liverpool, and there's an advert right there about the new coffee from McDonald's, so I don't know if it's about the pre-watershed thing, but I think it starts with individual parents, to be honest.
A few people there supporting the poll conducted by the Royal College of Paediatricians and Child Health that said nearly two-thirds of Britons want adverts banned. The Children's Food Campaign has worked in partnership with the British Heart Foundation to promote the campaign and says the decision to stop junk food advertising should be obvious. Malcolm Clark of the campaign told me more should be done to stop health problems amongst children.
Absolutely. That's something that's an issue that we've been campaigning on for a number of years now. And just think it's one of those things that actually is really a no-brainer. Around the times of 6, 7, 8 to 9 in the evening, those are the ones which actually the advertisers are now targeting with their chocolate, their junk food adverts, and that's what we'd like to see stopped. We need to do many different measures to get that rate down, to ensure that children are, you know, are fit, they're healthy, they have the best chance in life, and also that they enables them to stay healthier throughout their lives. And at the moment, unfortunately, the food industry is not supporting that initiative.
A petition started by 38 Degrees called Save Our NHS has accumulated over 365,000 signatures. The activists from 38 Degrees have been campaigning all across the UK, including in Merseyside, and they claim the NHS is their biggest priority leading up to the general election. Our reporter Hannah Cain spoke to one of the campaigners, India Fergood.
It's basically make or break time for the NHS at the moment, and it's become one of the biggest issues in the election campaign. And so we're trying to get our members on the streets, making sure that politicians promise to not privatise the NHS. What we're trying to do is obviously get as much support as possible for protecting our NHS so that politicians sit up and listen, and so they actually do take action. And so I think it's really important to be out on the streets for 38 Degrees members to be all across the country talking about the NHS with people. And it is something that people really, really care about and do want to support. We'll continue in the months ahead to be raising this issue on the streets with petitions and with different actions as well. To give it more funding, the funding that it deserves, and also to protect it from a trade deal called TTIP, which will basically open the NHS open to kind of take over by American companies.
And is this petition aimed towards all political parties or any in particular
ones?
Yeah,
so the petition's aimed towards all political parties, anyone standing in the election. So basically all of the candidates standing in your constituency to be your MP, we want them to make these promises on the NHS and make sure that they'll protect it.
Would this involve them prioritising putting more money into the NHS?
Absolutely. We want more money to be put into the NHS. Time and time again, doctors are saying that the NHS needs more funding. Actually, America, Germany, those of our countries all spend loads more than the UK does on their health service. And that's why we just need to invest in the health service. It's something that we all use and we all value.
What would you and other campaigners say to people who say that if more money is put into the NHS, then it would mean higher taxes for the public?
Well, we think the NHS is something worth paying for. You know, before the NHS existed, people who couldn't afford to have healthcare were going without. That's not something we want to see happen again. So we think that absolutely we're listening to doctors and nurses across the country who are saying the NHS needs more funding.
Do you think the doctors and expert commenting on the NHS and the privatisation may have personal motives such as pay and working conditions?
I think we all have personal interest in the NHS, really. I think, of course, NHS doctors want to get paid well, but I think they deserve to get paid well. But I think, you know, we all have vested interest in the NHS because absolutely all of us use it. And, you know, whether we're born there, we use its services until death. And so I think we all have interest in protecting the NHS.
In light of this campaign, I contacted the Department of Health for comments on the campaign's work, but they were unable to reply.
That was our reporter Hannah Kane speaking to 38 Degrees campaigner India Furugood.
For more on all the latest news, sport, entertainment, views and reviews, follow us on Twitter at JMU Journalism and come back often.
Now for all the latest sports news with our reporter Johnny Coop.
Liverpool have kept the pressure on Manchester United in their battle for a top four Premier League finish. They are now only 2 points off the Champions League places following Wednesday's 2-0 win over Burnley at Anfield. Vice-captain Jordan Henderson scored another cracker and then crossed in for Daniel Sturridge to head in on his return to the starting lineup, sealing 3 points, but in truth they never really got out of first gear. The win was further evidence that Liverpool boss Brendan Rodgers has restored an attacking verve to his team. Rodgers' men have now extended their unbeaten run to 12 games, winning 7 out of their last 8 in the league. And the Reds will go into Sunday's quarter-final FA Cup clash with Blackburn Rovers, brimmed full of confidence. However, it was another loss for Roberto Martinez's Everton side. They may be safely in the last 16 of the Europa League, but their position in the Premier League is looking severely threatened after losing 2-0 away at Stoke City on Wednesday night. The Toffees have now lost 7 out of their last 12 games and have only won 6 games all season, with a sticky fight for survival looming large. With only 10 games left, boss Roberto Martinez will treat each game as a cup final and stated that they aren't too good to go down. Relegation out of the Football League is looking increasingly more likely for Tranmere Rovers after a third consecutive loss. The 2-1 defeat at home to Wycombe Wanderers on Tuesday night leaves Tranmere one spot above the relegation places in League 2. Rovers came up short in delivering a spirited but flawed performance against a promotion-chasing Wycombe Wanderers side boasting the best away record in the League 2. Rovers have, however, signed Chesterfield attacking midfielder Dan Gardner on a one-month loan deal to stop the rot. Luis Suarez will play at Anfield for the first time since leaving Liverpool later this month. The Barcelona strikers to feature in a charity match for the Liverpool FC Foundation. Steven Gerrard and Jamie Carragher will each captain a side they have selected themselves on the 29th of March. The star-studded lineups will also feature fans' favourite Pepe Reina, Dirk Kuyt and Xavi Alonso. Proceeds raised will help fund the Liverpool FC Foundation community programmes which benefit thousands of young people and adults throughout the city of Liverpool. Tickets for this exciting event will be priced at £20 for adults and £5 for juniors and £15 for over 65, with tickets now available from the Liverpool Football Club website. Heptathlete Katrina Johnson-Thompson hopes a fearless attitude will help her win her first major title this week. Liverpool Dream will compete in the pentathlon for the first time since 2012 at the European Indoor Championships in Prague on Friday the 6th of March. Johnson-Thompson is one of the world's form athletes, ranked second in the world in the long jump and fourth in the high jump after breaking British indoor records in both events in recent weeks. Rocky Fielding hopes to settle his hometown rival with fellow Liverpool fighter Paul Smith in the near future. The unbeaten super middleweight fighter claims he's now ready to take on Smith in a showdown which he feels he will fill out the Liverpool Echo Arena. Fielding believes the more experienced rival has dismissed him in recent weeks and is determined to prove a point in front of his home fans. The 27-year-old will put his unbeaten record on the line against Oleg Fedotov in Hull this Saturday, the 7th of March.
That was our reporter, Johnny Cooper, with the sports roundup. The magic of silent films Safety Last was brought to life at the Liverpool Philharmonic last Saturday night. Our reporter, Beth and Tolly, went down there for Liverpool Life.
The film was originally shown to audiences in 1923 and starred one of the original kings of screen comedy, Harold Lloyd. It is a dangerous comedy of social climbing, not only in the department store where Harold's character worked, but in the finale which sees him climb the outside of a 12-storey building to earn the £1,000 he needs to marry his girlfriend. The incredible successful conductor Carl Davis, who was originally from New York, has written a number of scores for silent films. He wrote a new, full orchestral score for Safety Last. His aim was to bridge the gap between between the 1920s and a modern audience, making the film feel as contemporary now as it did then. I spoke to Carl about what made him want to get involved with the music for Safety Last and what the highlight of his career has been.
There is an underlying theme to all these comedies, and you know, the essence of Lloyd is, you know, to be Mr. Abbott, the American dream, you know, to be rich, you know, to have things that you show off. So I find it very kind of peculiarly American subject, an American attitude towards. This is a particular sort of, we want to show that we can do well, and in a way a department store, which is, you know, has everything for available to everybody, is a very good symbol for that department store life and succeeding there and seeing
it. So was it difficult to ensure that the music stayed in sync with the vision?
A lot of it depends on how well I've written it to do it. Music can be measured just as film can be measured. They both exist in time. So, you know, it's a question of how well I control time and my tempo and then compose the music to fit. If I've done my job well, from just purely organizing of the spaces, then cues to myself of where I should be at any one point. And so that it is actually controlling time. And controlling myself, because the film will be the same, but as people, we change every day, every minute. We're a little slower, blood sugar, or, you know, every factor that makes you a little slower or a little faster, adrenaline makes you faster, you know, all these sort of things. So I always have to respond to my mood, to the orchestra's mood. How are they? Time of day.
You've written a number of film scores now. Yes. So how do you go about actually composing this type of music?
Well, first of all, I have to have some understanding of the film. You know, what are we after? What period is it in? Is it a comedy, a tragedy? Is it a one-off, oddball thing? You know, what is it that's going to be interesting about the film? You know, and how you're going to go in. So I tend to want a lot of information about the film before I start off. Well, you know, here's a film made in 1925, so, you know, that's the heyday of the jazz age, you know, and so, you know, you want the score to reflect what's contemporary at the time the film was made.
What has been the absolute highlight of your career?
November 30th, 1980 was the premiere of the very first one of these we performed in this way. But it was a historical film called Napoleon, and it was 5 hours long, and I had to actually find and write music and work out how to conduct, because I had no experience of doing this whatsoever. And I think that first performance was highly significant, because it just, for all of us, opened the door, you know, that we were doing something very special. And it's also one of these films which are very heroic in scale and in ambition and so on. So the music had to be very ecstatic and you know, kind of really drawing people into some extraordinary. So that night, you know, when everything was revealed to the public at the packed house in London, via Leicester Square, you know, we all thought something quite extraordinary has happened. And then as a team with my colleagues and Thames Television, Channel 4 was just starting, the whole thing took a shape, we were commissioned, we would go on, and from that point on to today, you know, I've composed over 60 scores, and, you know, I'm like a one-man ballet company or a one-man opera company, you know, except instead of the operas, I've got the films.
That's all for Liverpool Life's podcast this week. A special thanks to this week's editor, Dan O'Brien. I'm Luke Holliday. Thanks very much for listening.
This has been the Liverpool Life podcast, brought to you by the journalism students at the Redmond's News Centre. More next week.